Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
If you need someone to count on, count me in.
The 2020 census count has been completed. Will lawmakers use the count to accurately draw legislative districts? We'll hear from an expert. Plus, one of the Twin Ports' hottest bands heads for the West Coast. We'll have one last local interview with one less guest. All that and the regional news and review after this.
Issues from a superior point of view.
If you need someone to count on, count me in.
The 2020 census count has been completed. Will lawmakers use the count to accurately draw legislative districts? We'll hear from an expert.
Count me in, look at them, or they don't count.
Plus, one of the Twin Ports' hottest bands heads for the West Coast. We'll have one last local interview with one less guest. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Wisconsin has often been called one of the most gerrymandered states in the Union, and our own 7th Congressional District is cited as a prime example. Yet it's not new or unique to Wisconsin. It's an American tradition going back to Elbridge Gerry, the 5th Vice President of the United States, who's credited, or blamed, for creating a Massachusetts congressional district in the shape of a salamander, to which critics appended his name. The practice comes like clockwork when representative districts are redrawn after each census to favor whatever party is in control of the statehouse. Yet there are proposals to take redistricting away from politicians and put it in the hands of independent and nonpartisan committees. Will they work? My colleague Shireen Seward from WPR's Wausau Bureau spoke with someone with a deep understanding of the matter. Eric Giordano is the founding director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Here's their conversation.
I'm Shireen Seward. Redistricting is a high-stakes endeavor, one that can directly impact the lives of people living in Wisconsin for years to come. In Governor Tony Evers' 2020 State of the State address, he created a nonpartisan redistricting commission comprising the people of our state, not elected officials, not lobbyists, and not political party officials, who will draw the people's maps. They've pledged to work together to draw fair and impartial maps for the legislature to take up this year. But the issue of fairness is also a matter of debate, and as things stand today, Wisconsin is often referred to as the most gerrymandered state in the country. Joining us today to make sense of Wisconsin's redistricting process is political scientist Eric Giordano. He is the executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service.
Thanks, Shireen. Great to be here.
So, Eric, let's start with the history of redistricting. So, when did the requirement begin? Is this something that states have always done or not?
Right. Well, there is some constitutional provisions around census taking and districting, but actually before the 1960s, there was really a huge amount of diversity in election law regarding redistricting throughout the states and the Republic at that time. And a lot of it really had to do with issues around initially slavery and how slaves were counted as part of the census and apportioned. And then part of it was to protect, you know, the interests of southern states and frankly, even northern states later when immigrant populations started to come in. And so there were a lot of really different approaches to redistricting and apportionment that were done by the states. You know, since the Baker versus Card Supreme Court decision in the 1960s and the Voting Rights Act, really the Supreme Court kind of clamped down on the idea that When districts were drawn, they had to be roughly equal. And so you couldn't just simply change the numbers of people that were in one district versus another. So really, those the states now can determine within a certain percentage how many people are in each district. But since that time, Wisconsin has, you know, redistrict based on the census every 10 years, and it roughly has to divide up the number of districts based on the apportionment that's received on the base of the census. So, for example, today, you know, there are 8 districts.
And that's different from other states. They have different processes from state to state then.
Right. Well, there are definitely different processes in place. So about 33 states, the responsibility for redrawing districts is empowered within the legislature or the legislative branch. And then there's often a executive veto power, and that's the case in Wisconsin, and most states do follow that. But then there are a number of states that use other sorts of systems. So, for example, Michigan has a non-politician commission that it uses. Colorado has a similar thing. So does Arizona and California. And then there are a couple of states like New York in which they've created a basically non-political commission that drafts the maps, and the legislature can accept or reject that. And then Virginia has something similar. So yeah, there are many different ways to do it, but the most states do it the way Wisconsin does, which is to have the legislature be in charge of essentially drawing the maps, and then the governor gets to decide if he's going to accept or reject that. But the governor, as you've pointed out, has created this commission. And so there is a process that underway through the executive branch where he is, and the people that are working on this commission are going to be drawing some maps, but then they have to present those to the legislature, and the legislature has to either accept, amend, or, you know, do something to approve them. And then the governor can decide if he likes what they have, how they have amended it or approved it.
I want to just simplify things here. When districts drawn, what impact does it have?
There's a couple practical ramifications that have little to do with politics, maybe, but have a lot to do with how Wisconsin, receives funds in terms of the apportionment, right? So I'm not talking about districting now. I'm talking about the process of the census determining how many seats Wisconsin will have, how many districts it will have, and seats in Congress. That can change based on the census. It doesn't appear that that's going to change for Wisconsin. So we're still going to basically have 8 representatives. So, but when it comes to the redistricting piece, that has huge implications for political parties and the ability of parties to control not only who gets elected to the Congress, but really right down to the ward and district level for who gets elected to the Wisconsin Assembly and Senate, because all of those boundaries ultimately start at that level and then go outward from there. Right? Because one of the things that the state constitution demands about our redistricting in Wisconsin is that we do try to take into account the municipal and county boundaries and try to adhere to those boundaries when possible. So, but, you know, you can split sometimes those things. You can, you know, draw the lines differently. And depending on how you draw them, you know, there's this kind of concept of cracking and packing that maybe some of your viewers have heard about. You can pack together certain types of individuals who tend to vote a certain way, or you can split districts in a way that dilutes the power of certain groups and their ability to influence politics. So ultimately, when it comes right down to it, this really has huge impacts for who gets to control the legislature in Wisconsin, and ultimately, the election for the congressional seats as well.
You're listening to Eric Giordano. He is our guest today for a discussion on the redistricting process underway in Wisconsin and its potential impact on the lives of the people of Wisconsin. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Wisconsin Public Radio. Eric, we were talking a little bit about gerrymandering. Is there a specific part of Wisconsin that gerrymandering seems to be the biggest issue, or is this statewide?
Well, of course, I think to some extent it's statewide because, like I was saying earlier, right, when we redraw these boundaries every year, it really starts from the ground up. I mean, it really starts at the, at the level of the assembly districts and the Senate districts, and then it kind of trickles up, if you will, from there, because a collection of those districts then join together to form the congressional districts. And of course, that's based somewhat on population, and we have to make sure that there's roughly equal population in each district. So it's kind of a complex process. But, so all of that is taken into consideration if you're, say, the Democrats or the Republicans, if you're trying to, control the legislature, get as many safe seats, quote unquote, safe seats as you can. Have control over the assembly and the Senate, and ultimately, get as many representatives from your party in Congress elected, then you really have to pay attention to all of it. So you might say, well, and down in Milwaukee, we're going to, make sure that the maps are drawn in a way that, are obviously going to pack people who vote, Democratic, which tends to be the case in urban areas, into as, as few districts as possible. And then we're going to maybe spread some other districts out in a way that ensures, packing people who support Republicans into those districts. So how has this affected the actual map? I think the most clear example of this kind of crazy, map drawing is really the 7th CD right here, right? I think most of us know that. If you just look at the shape, it's of the district itself. It is a very strange looking district, which clearly tries to, get certain groups into the district and leave other groups out, particularly in comparison to what it looked like, back before 2010.
How does Wisconsin compare with other states when it comes to these irregularly shaped districts around the country? Is this the norm?
Well, yes, it is the norm in some states, and we can name probably the top three. I guess egregious gerrymandered states would be Wisconsin. They're definitely in the top three. Maryland, and usually most people kind of throw North Carolina in there, and there are others as well. But on the other hand, there are some states that seem to have, chosen a different path and sort of have a different approach. And I think I've mentioned a few of those. I think New York, Virginia, Iowa is probably the poster child of this kind of fair maps approach to redistricting. And really, we've seen evidence of this in Washington State, in Idaho, and other places where, there are ways that districts can be drawn a little more fairly. So, yeah, states have taken a lot of different approaches to try to reduce gerrymandering, but I think the majority of states still offer a lot of opportunity for gerrymandering, and Wisconsin just happens to be one of the most egregious in the sense, and I think it's partly because of it's basically controlled by the Republican Party at this point, so they're able to have that power to redraw those maps favorably to them. Now, this time around, 2020, it's going to be very interesting because although the legislature is dominated by the Republicans, the governor is a Democrat and he has veto power. So that'll be a very fascinating negotiation to see where we end up in terms of how these maps are drawn in after 2020.
So we've touched on the fair maps issue, and this is over the last several years, 54 Wisconsin counties at last check, representing about 80% of the people of Wisconsin, have passed these resolutions or referenda supporting nonpartisan redistricting in Wisconsin. But who ultimately determines what is fair?
I think that's ultimately, if you put your finger right on it, Shereen, I mean, this is part of the challenge of trying to, draw maps in general and then come out of it and say, yes, this was fair, or maybe to accuse the other side of drawing maps in a way that's unfair. And I think it's sort of why the Supreme Court to date has consistently basically said, look, we do not feel like this is can be a adjudicated by the courts, right? This is an issue for the legislatures of each state to determine, what they want and how they want to do it. And I think, this is really the issue because, in a winner take all type system that we have here, there's a lot riding on this. And so, a lot of the comments that, I've heard from Republican friends after the redrawing of maps, based on the 2010 census was, hey, look, all's fair in politics. And, you know, we have the majority in the Assembly and the Senate. We control the executive office. So it's our prerogative, you know, to draw these maps. And if they favor us, that's fair because that's our system. And if the Democrats win, then they can just, you know, do the same thing. And they have done the same thing in the past. But it's tough to figure out what fair is under those circumstances.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the Fair Maps Commission. In Governor Tony Evers' 2020 State of the State address, he created this nonpartisan redistricting commission I mentioned earlier. They are not elected officials. They're not lobbyists. They're not political party officials. And these are the folks who are going to initially draw the maps and then pass them on. But when we're talking about political appointees, is it really possible to have a nonpartisan group? I guess, in other words, if they're appointed by a Democrat, would you expect the appointees to lean in that political direction or not?
Well, I think if I'm a Republican, I'm immediately going to assume that the people appointed to that commission are going to lean Democrat. Now, I know that in his executive order, he has a very explicit language there about nonpartisan members. So I would like, you know, to take him at his word. Can the Republicans trust that he will? And that's really a question that's open for debate. It kind of gets back, even though whether they're partisan or nonpartisan, it still gets back to the question of, you know, what is fair? And I think there is an answer that I think the fair vote folks would probably say, which is, you know, it's not that we have to have maps that guarantee one party or the other, you know, have certain number of seats versus the other, but maybe it's about making these districts and the races within the district election races competitive so that, you know, we're not necessarily having these kind of huge voting disparities. Like I think after the 2016 election, there was only one congressional district in Wisconsin that a candidate won with less than 20% margin of victory over the opponent. So in other words, that's a huge gap between the winners and the losers. And a lot of that gap really has to do with how the districts were divided up because our state itself does not have that kind of a gap when it comes to voting patterns in the last, you know, 8 years. I mean, we're pretty much right down the middle, you know, almost 50-50, but our elections and the results of those elections don't reflect that because of the way that these districts are drawn. So maybe a version of fairness, you know, no matter who draws the maps, might be more competitive districts. And we can talk about why that's important because that really has ramifications, not just for which party controls power, but whether the extremes from each party are going to have a bigger voice over the moderate middle. But that's something we can talk about if you'd like in more detail.
Sure. Well, go ahead. I'd like to hear more about that.
Well, I think that's part of the reason why, you know, this fair maps and fair voting kind of movement has really taken hold in a lot of states and really nationally, because I think people are kind of generally not at the extremes in our country. I mean, we've always been sort of a country that's in theory had a moderate middle, or at least a group that we, you know, consider a moderate middle that may shift a little left, a little right, but most of us are not sort of at the extremes. But what's happening because of the gerrymandering and the way districts are drawn is that it is encouraging safe seats. I think the last I heard from some research is that 85% of the congressional seats in for the U.S. Congress are now considered safe seats. In other words, each party has a lock, no matter who they put up as a candidate, no matter, you know, who the opponents put up as a candidate, either the district's going to go Democrat or Republican, and we can predict that almost 85% of the time. If you think about it, that means that the kind of candidates that are likely to run for office or be selected for office in those districts are going to really represent a fraction of the people who actually vote. And they may be a little bit more to the extreme, more partisan than we're, and I think we're seeing this really across the board in terms of who's elected. So if you don't like, you know, Ilhan Omar, you think she's too progressive, or you don't like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene because you think she's, you know, too extreme on the right. Part of the reason they're able you know, to get in there with more extreme viewpoints is because their districts are completely safe because of the gerrymandered nature of those districts.
Thank you very much for this fascinating discussion. I'm Shereen Seewert. Once again, thanks to our guest, Eric Giordano. He is the executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service.
That was my colleague Shereen Seewert from WPR's Wausau Bureau speaking with Eric Giordano, the founding director of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, about the longstanding partisan practices and possible reform in drawing representative districts. Coming up, one last local interview with one last guest.
Questions come in waves. Do you have please don't leave me waiting, just praying on the tide. Somewhere there's a port.
I hope you're driving down the highway.
If that sounds like a road song, it is, because our guests coming up, and that's a clue of who they are about to hit the road. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. One Less Guest is one of the hottest bands in the area. And if you think that's not too hard to do around here with our temperatures, we mean they're really good. And I don't know if weather has anything to do with it, but they're so good, they're moving on to sunny California. We can't let them go without one more visit, following up their appearance on the show just a few months ago, when, believe me, it was cold. Joining us from Superior are Ren Cooper, also known as Lauren Cooper, and Nick Muska. Welcome back to Simply Superior.
Hi, Robin. Thank you for having us again.
Thanks for being here. And I appreciate your thank you last time, in which you actually dropped off a One Less Guest Christmas ornament at my home. And A, that tells you the time of year we were doing it, and B, it was the blizzard. Does everybody remember that blizzard?
Yeah, I remember putting those packages outside of people's houses, and they just kept, like, sliding off of their, like, entryways because it was so frozen and windy. I'm glad it made it to you.
Well, it did, and don't feel bad about this, but we had a screen door that wasn't latching very well. So as I went out and said, what's this? And I saw this package, wham, it opened up and got me right in the head.
Oh, no.
Luckily, I have a thick head, so don't worry about it.
Oh, no.
And just this week, I fixed the screen door. Okay.
Oh.
This is not a plug, but thank you to Steve at Marshall Hardware. So all it needed was a little spring. So I guess that's a pun there.
Okay.
So you are leaving us. You're tired of all these blizzards and everything. Or tell me why you're headed on and where you're going.
Yeah, well, it's not an easy answer, and it wasn't an easy decision to make. But I guess how the band progressed is Cody is our newest member, but we've known him for a while. We're all really good friends with him, and he's graduating with his master's in percussion. And he grew up in Anaheim.
Cody Thorson.
Yeah, he's our drummer. Yep. And so he really wants to, you know, just move forward with his career and be closer to his family because he had a loss in his family in the last year. That was been pretty tough on him. So that was kind of a part of it for him. And then he just kind of long shotted this question to us of, hey, guys, I know you're probably, this is pretty crazy, you know, with everything that's going on in the world and just, you know, the timing, I know it's not that long a notice, but would you guys want to come out to California with me and keep the band going out there? And we're all pretty stunned because, you know, it takes a lot of guts to ask that question out of three people that have lived up here most of their whole lives, you know.
The fourth member of the band is Nick Glass, your bassist.
Yeah. That's right.
So that's what I was going to say is it's not just three people. It's three people who absolutely love the Twin Ports. You've got Superior mm-hmm. and Duluth roots, right?
You're right.
Right.
And have either of you been to sunny California?
I've been out there a few times.
I have never been there. I've only seen pictures and heard about it, so I'm not fully convinced that it's real. We're going to find out.
So what else did he say to convince you?
Well, honestly, he didn't say much more than that, because I think it was a hope of his, but I think he kind of thought that, you know, this is kind of, like I said, a long shot. But the stars kind of lined up, and, you know, for me, it's like I can kind of go round and round in my head and come up with a bunch of logical reasons, and I'm pretty good at that. But what it really came down to was when he first asked the question, it felt right in my gut, mm-hmm. you know? And I think, you know, obviously we all took some time to think about it, but I just remember he asked us in rehearsal, and maybe Lauren, she probably remembers us driving home from rehearsal, just the two of us in my van, and we were just kind of talking it over.
Yeah, talking it over, I remember like trying to find reasons to stay, and my brain just totally coming up empty, in the sense of like, obviously there's family and so many things that I absolutely love about Duluth, but I've been here my entire life. I've grown up here, and just the thought of leaving and seeing what I can become outside of this town and what this town has given me as a person just really resonated and felt right with me. After Cody asked that question of what direction I wanted to go, and yeah, I just remember talking in the van and being super excited and not really having time to doubt anything. The doubt came later, but we've worked on it, and I think we've covered all of our bases, and I'm still feeling really great about it.
We're speaking with Rin Cooper, also known as Lauren Cooper, and Nick Muska from the band One Less Guest. And there'll be one less guest, unfortunately, here in the Duluth Superior area as they head out to California. Is it L.A. or San Francisco? Where or exactly?
So we'll be moving to Anaheim, which is right below, right south of L.A.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't just a move, and this isn't just the, I'm going to date myself here, do you know the way to San Jose, California, where you're planning on being a star? I mean, you already have careers. You're doing well with this music deal here in the Twin Ports. You know, how do you pick it up and take it somewhere else? Do you have an agent?
Well, thank you for your kind words. And no, we don't currently have an agent. But Nick's been doing a pretty good job these past 3 or so years of keeping us connected and helping us reach out to people. And I'm pretty confident that we're going to find some really great people to network with and talk to and places to play at as we just get out there and meet people.
For me, it will be kind of fun to try out my skill set and see if it applies to a bigger, more, you know, competitive market. I am kind of like, have a little bit of a business mentality. I guess I see this band as like, you know, I love promoting and I love networking and a lot of the non-music stuff. And it'll be really fun to just kind of cut my teeth out there and just see, although I would welcome help. I'm getting better at that as I get older, but just being like, okay, it's, you know, unless you want to be our agent, Robin.
I'll be the guy who puts you on a radio every now and then. So.
All right. That works yeah. for us.
But, you know, what that means is actually I'm the guy playing your music, which is what we should do right now. Why don't you give us a song that, how about this? I'll make a challenge for you that you think the people in Anaheim in the LA area absolutely should hear first to be introduced to One Less Guest.
Well, Cody, like I said, he's from out there, and so maybe we should play his favorite song on the album, Breeze, which is track 2 on our Monochrome album.
All right, let's hear Breeze by One Less Guest.
Took my horn, darling.
Please don't leave me waiting, just praying on the tide. Somewhere there's a port outside of the storm, but I got no way to get there if I'm sailing on.
That was Breeze by One Less Guest, two of whom are our guests, Ren Cooper, a.k.a. Lauren Cooper, and Nick Muska, who are speaking to us from Superior at the moment. And if we're lucky, we can get them to stay in Superior by taking the air out of their tires or maybe hiding their musical instruments. Ren, do you know where you put your violin? No, I have it. It's in our studios. Yeah. The reason we're doing this is because they're leaving us for the L.A. area. Tell us, well, I don't know. You know, do you have a place to stay? You're not all going out there in a VW microbus, right?
I mean, kind of. We have our big blue band van that's all souped up and ready to go. So that's our version of the microbus. As for places to stay, we definitely have the trip out there all planned out with hotels and Airbnbs and such. Most rental companies want you to be in state when you sign a lease. So that's the only thing that's kind of holding us up. But we feel it's going to be all right once we get our feet on the ground out there.
How big is the not microbus?
Oh boy, yeah. I kind of lucked into a 1996 Chevy Express conversion van. It's the Gladiator package, so all blue exterior with the silver striping down the side, and it's got plush blue suede interior from floor to ceiling, and blue plush captain's chairs and wood paneling. Of course, you got to have the wood paneling. But no, it's really been kind of cool. It gets like 12 miles to the gallon, but it's fun as hell, or fun as heck, sorry. And it can fit all four of us and all of our gear. By the time this has aired, we'll have played a show at St. Croix Winery, and we'll have taken the van down there for that.
Well, most importantly, if somebody wants to see you, which they should, before you head out, you are doing a farewell show today.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time.
Yeah, we'll be playing at the Earth Rider Brewery from 6:30 to 9, and tickets are hopefully still on sale. I know the tickets are selling pretty fast, And you can find those on Eventbrite or through the Facebook event link on Earth Writers Facebook page.
All right. Great. We are speaking with Wren Cooper and Nick Muska from One Less Guest. This is one last performance that they're doing tonight at the Earth Writer Brewery. So let's hear something else that you would like Southern Californians to hear as their introduction to you.
All right. How about we do Deja Vu, Lauren? What do you think about that?
That sounds good.
And set up Deja Vu for us?
Deja Vu is, it just kind of builds. This was a really fun song for us because we all kind of wrote the beginning of it together in a rehearsal. And it's just a really collaborative song. I like the violin and guitar lead that Lauren and I do together at the end of the song.
All right. Here's Deja Vu by One Less Guest.
Thank you.
And that was Deja Vu by One Less Guest. You're always welcome back on the show. And of course, we can always play your music. So, and at that, let's hear one more. How about something as a parting song to take us out?
Let's do Where You Are. I think that's a good one to end on.
That sounds like a perfect parting song. We've been speaking with Wren Cooper, who plays the violin, by the way, Nick Muska on guitar. Nick Glass, who plays the bass, is not with us today, and neither is Cody Thorson on the drums, who is the reason they are moving to Southern California. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. Bye.
I want a bottle of the sunshine. Send it across these thousand miles. Put a postage stamp on a point in time. Mail it to you and make you smile. I know there's this space between us. Those mountains sure look tall. I hope you know that it don't matter much. I could send my love across it all.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So the Centers for Disease Control said last week that you don't have to wear a mask anymore if you've been vaccinated. That caught everyone by surprise from the White House on down. And you still do have to wear them on airplanes and pretty much wherever else they're still mandated. But states immediately responded by lifting their mask mandates, even though, of course, no one can tell if you've been vaccinated or not. And the whole country is on the honor system. So what's going on locally? And I'll point out, by the way, that we're recording this early in the week and things may change. Danny?
Yeah, well, on Tuesday, Douglas County said that fully vaccinated people can resume activities without wearing a mask in line with the CDC guidance. And so basically, you know, in a year where more than 4,000 people tested positive for COVID-19 in the county and 39 people have died, now we're starting to return to some normalcy. Although they do note, like, as you said, that, you know, mask wearing or physical distancing may be required in some locations or businesses. And so they want people to adhere to that guidance, but also noting at the same time that the scientists agree that the vaccine protects against transmission and hospitalization and death from the disease. So now a lot of communities, likely they will lift their mask resolution, highly unlikely that they would keep it in place.
Brooks, on the Minnesota side, I imagine a lot of that is the same there.
Yeah, last week, Governor Walz was quick to move toward ending the statewide mask mandate, which then left a patchwork of local rules in place. Duluth had its mask mandate in place before the state issued one last summer. So what we saw was, again, a quick action trickling down from federal to state to local. The city council is poised to officially repeal the Duluth mask mandate on Monday. But for now, the mayor has already said, no, we're not enforcing it. And it's up to businesses to decide for themselves what they want to do. And already that has created some taking down signs and some keeping them up. So the best action right now is to keep a mask in your pocket or in your car, because some businesses are going to continue to require them. That could continue for weeks to come. But as on the other side of the border, yes, it is patchwork, and it is moving away from the mask mandate and toward voluntary masking.
All right. Well, now that we are in what we hope are the closing days of the pandemic, are people heading back to work in a physical space, and particularly in downtown Duluth?
Well, you know, I'm talking to you from my office in downtown Duluth, and I'll say it looks a lot busier than it was even a month ago. You know, a recent survey from the Greater Downtown Council of Duluth said, found that 80% of businesses are going to allow more flexibility, although more than half will expect workers in the office at least 3 days a week, which has to be good news for some businesses downtown that need that foot traffic, restaurants and the like. You know, there's sort of a mix right now as we're in this transition period, just like with masks. You know, we've got hundreds of workers who are typically stationed at Minnesota Power's downtown office. Most of them have worked remotely since the beginning of the pandemic. In June, more of them will be given the option to return. And then, August, September is when the more hybrid model will begin. So I think this work from home, while not completely permanent, will continue to be a trend.
All right. Well, what if we don't want to go downtown, but just get out of here and head for the border, specifically the Canadian one? Can we get across it yet?
No, get ready to get turned around if you do make it all the way to the border, because as of now and for the foreseeable future, non-essential travel into Canada remains extremely limited. You have to have a very good reason to cross the border. And that's leaving a lot of families separated. That's leaving businesses who count on that cross-border travel looking for that lost revenue, and it's even keeping some frustrations alive, of course, in the northwest angle. I talked to a resort owner this week who said, people are just frustrated. They've absolutely had it. And the latest update we have on the border is that Canadian officials are beginning talks about the reopening, which is one step of many toward the actual reopening, because Canada right now is in a massive, major lockdown due to a COVID surge there. So most folks think that, we're not going to bounce quickly from lockdown to border reopening, but there should be some hope that by later this summer, again, is the hope, no guarantee, that border should be less restrictive.
Okay. Well, Danny, so maybe we won't head to Canada and just stay in our local waters. But if we're hanging around Howard's Bay and Superior, we might run into some activity.
Yeah, recently the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency began dredging contaminated sediments from Howard's Bay, which is part of the St. Louis River Area of Concern, one of 43 sites on the Great Lakes considered the most polluted hotspots on the lakes. And so this is a milestone in the cleanup of the St. Louis River Area of Concern in Superior. They're going to dredge approximately 75,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment. That sediment has things in it like metals, like lead and mercury, and some words I don't even know how to pronounce. Basically, it's all from fossil fuels like coal, gasoline, and oil. And so they're going to be taking that out. It's going to cost at least $12 million to clean up, and that is already underway.
All right. Well, once we get the dredging figured out, how about the ice? Is there a chance we could get year-round shipping?
It's a possibility that researchers at UW-Superior are going to be studying over the next year. Richard Stewart, who is the director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UWS, is going to be taking a look at this along with Daniel Rust. And this is all because we've seen, reduced ice cover on the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes as a whole are seeing a 5% decline in their annual maximum ice cover each decade. And that's actually even more than that in Lake Superior. And so they're going to look at cargo movements on the lakes and coming up with these models, looking at three main cargoes, taconite, coal, and limestone, and the potential operational or economic impacts if the shipping season were extended by anywhere from 20 days to 50 days. And so this is something that they're going to be looking at to try and get an idea of whether or not there might be some potential benefits or setbacks of a potential year-round shipping season.
All right. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/North Report. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. Next week,
for a few stolen hours, you'll be all right.
It's a return visit with Bill and Kate Isles, or Kate and Bill Isles if you prefer.
My hobo's slim,
in the roundhouse tonight.
We'll hear what the singer-songwriter duo is up to after 60 straight weeks of online concerts. That's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of One Less Guest, and even if you don't have to wear your mask, stay safe, everyone.
Maybe someday things will go our way. Until then, my heart will be.